Money FM 89.3, best of prime time.
You're listening to Prime Time on Money FM 89.3. I'm Rachel Kelly, and in this weekly segment, we speak to BBC journalists about the international stories they're tracking in the week ahead. We're joined today by BBC editor Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, welcome back.
Yes, thank you very much, Rachel.
Wonderful to have you with us. I hope you've been keeping safe and healthy.
I have. Have you? I hope you have.
Likewise. And we'll start off with the COVID-19 situation, Rob, because COVID-19 remains the big story over much of the world. What are some of the latest angles on this that have caught your eye?
Well, Rachel, there are so many things to talk about, aren't there, with COVID. It's the front page of every newspaper and every bulletin, of course. If you look at the BBC newscast bulletin, you know, the top three or four stories are always at the moment dedicated to COVID in one form or other. So multiple different angles. But I guess one way of looking at it is looking at the top three countries, the countries that are most badly affected, if you like, the top still being the United States. They're talking about some, you know, 400,000 people have lost their lives as a result of COVID since the beginning of this pandemic, which is extraordinary. And Biden, of course, being inaugurated, all being well, on Wednesday, and saying that he would like to carry out 100 million vaccinations in the first 100 days of his administration. So the big drive in the U.S. is for vaccinations, as it is elsewhere. If you look in India, India is the second on that list in terms of badly affected countries, and it wants to vaccinate 300 million people by August, according to its leader, Narendra Modi, and that would be the largest vaccination program in the world. The third on the list is Brazil, and its health regulator over the weekend approved the emergency use of the Oxford AstraZeneca and China's Sinovac vaccines. And its mass inoculation program will begin on Wednesday. So, you know, if you look at the three kind of macro stories, if you like, in COVID in terms of big countries, you can see that all efforts now on multiple and mass vaccinations with multiple different vaccines. And in Brazil's case, you know, this is interesting, very contentious, because Jair Bolsonaro, the leader, was kind of anti-COVID, dismissive of COVID, not wearing a mask, following in the footsteps of Donald Trump. But, you know, now he's had to eat his words because Brazil is severely affected. Even if you look at the city of Manaus in the Amazon, some 76% of that city were considered to have got COVID in the first wave, but they're seeing another surge now. So, you know, what is that? Is that the Brazilian variant, or what is it? Either way, Brazil has a mountain to climb, as do the United States and India and so many other countries.
And Rob, let's talk about the World Health Organization team, because they've arrived in China. They've been there for a few days. What sort of access are they getting?
Well, this is very interesting. There's a 10-man team, and, you know, China was resistant to the team coming and the investigation happening, and that's because China saw it as a, you know, another opportunity for foreigners, if you like, to bash China over this whole COVID origination issue. If we remember, you know, looking back, China began by saying, well, this virus was first detected in Wuhan, in the wet market in Wuhan. But if you look at Chinese state media, you know, recently, well, they're pointing the finger at Italy, Spain. They're even saying, you know, American troops may even have brought the virus to China. American forces took part in the World Military Games in Wuhan in the autumn of 2019, and Chinese state media suggesting that maybe, you know, Americans brought the virus to China, and that it didn't actually originate in China at all. So, you know, a lot of questions are being asked, and it's the job of this team to figure out, well, what was the true origin of this virus? There are even some people, of course, speculating that that lab, that laboratory in Wuhan may have been the source, it may have been a leak, which, of course, the Chinese deny. But, you know, it's the job of this team to be open-minded and to try and get whatever access they can. I should say, you know, a lot of people are skeptical about that because China has allowed the trip. China has said samples and evidence and so on will be provided by Chinese officials. So, you know, some people are questioning the objectivity of this investigation. But either way, it'll be very interesting to see, you know, what sort of access do they get, what sort of evidence can they see, and ultimately, and this may take a long time, you know, what conclusions do they finally reach? Because it's not just important for this virus, but of course any future virus as well.
Now, Rob, moving on to the big event of this week, this coming Wednesday, we'll see the inauguration of America's new president, Joe Biden. And he has an enormous amount in his in-tray. What are some of the main tasks ahead for him, and what's he been saying about them?
Well, it's an incredible in-tray. I mean, when you stop and think what it is. But, you know, first and foremost, he's got to get through the inauguration. There are 25,000 National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. There's a 7-foot fence surrounding the Capitol building. I've just seen on the BBC News Bulletin that they are screening each member of that 25,000 National Guard, and that's because in the attack on the Capitol building that has proved so contentious, it turns out that some of those people who were defending that building did have sympathies with the people who were attacking it.
Right.
So that there is concern that, you know, that can every one of those 25,000 National Guard troops be trusted, and therefore a kind of heavy screening program is going on at the moment. So that's the first thing. But beyond that, of course, Biden has an enormous in-tray. I mean, it's hard to think of any major issue that he isn't going to have to tackle because of what's happened really over the last 4 years and how incredibly polarized America now is. Rachel, if you don't mind, I did have a chat with our Washington, D.C. correspondent, and I asked him just to tell me in about a minute or less, you know, what are the principal issues in Biden's in-tray? So let me just play you that clip. Here we go.
Joe Biden will begin his presidency with a lot on his plate. First and foremost, we'll be addressing the twin public health and economic crises related to the coronavirus pandemic. He's proposing a $1.9 trillion aid package to boost vaccination production and distribution and provide additional help for schools, businesses, state and local governments, and the unemployed. After that, Biden's choices diverge. He said he wants to improve health care in the U.S. by expanding on reforms enacted when he was vice president. He's promised to make college more affordable and pass an infrastructure spending bill. And he'll try to tackle climate change through legislation as well as new regulations. He also plans a dramatic departure from Donald Trump's foreign policy, with a greater emphasis on international alliances. He says he will quickly rejoin the World Health Organization, the Paris Climate Accord, and the Iran nuclear agreement. He has to do all of this while trying to fulfill his promise of unifying the nation and tamping down on the violence and unrest that have cast a shadow over his inauguration.
So, Rachel, that was Anthony Zerker, our Washington, D.C. correspondent. I should say that the stimulus bill that Biden has proposed, he is hoping to create 18 million jobs as a result of that. So, you know, you can see that on the one hand, he's got to stabilize the economy in the United States. On the other, he's got to deal with the pandemic, absolutely huge. But multiple issues exist behind that. Because, of course, when Trump came in, he turned everything back. He turned the clock back on everything that Obama had done. Now that Biden's coming in, he's turning the clock back on pretty much everything that Trump had done. So it does raise, you know, big question marks about democracy, really, that the pendulum is swinging so wildly in America. And some people are just hoping, you know, that Biden's arrival, Kamala Harris, the first vice president, or female vice president, of course, that their arrival will bring some real stability and some consistency to America and American politics.
We're speaking with Rob Hugh Jones, editor at the BBC. And Rob, while we've got you on the line, there's one more topic that we wanted to get your updates on, and that, you know, that there are various anniversaries this week around the 10th anniversary of the Arab Spring. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so it's 10 years ago that the Arab Spring happened. Of course, it feels, you know, it feels like just a couple of years ago, doesn't it? But it's 10 years. And this all began, if you remember, in Tunisia, in North Africa. A 26-year-old market trader was fed up with local corruption and being harassed by local officials, and so killed himself, self-immolated, set himself on fire. And that set off protests in Tunis and across Tunisia, and then a domino effect across North Africa and the Middle East, many, many countries. And in Tunisia, what they managed to do was managed to kick out the authoritarian leader, Ben Ali, and establish a democratic system. But, you know, if you even look at the news of the past weekend, well, there have been demonstrations in Tunisia, in various mm-hmm. different cities, hundreds of people arrested. One third of the young people in Tunisia are unemployed. There's a lot of restlessness. There's a lot of people unhappy with corruption at the top. So, you know, whatever the objectives and the hopes and dreams 10 years ago, many people feel, you know, disappointed they haven't yet been realized. Of course, if you were a Chinese diplomat, you look at the long, much longer term, much longer sweep of history. So you might sort of question the effect of the Arab Spring in 50 years, not just after 10 years. But those who are looking after 10 years can see that many countries that were involved in the Arab Spring have really not turned out the way that the protesters had hoped. And if you look at like countries like Syria, mm-hmm. Yemen, Libya, you know, these countries descended into really vicious and large-scale civil wars. In Yemen, there was a Saudi intervention. In Libya, there was a U.S.-backed intervention. You know, it's been a rocky path for these countries. Even in Egypt, they got rid of Hosni Mubarak, who'd been there for about 30-odd years. Even they had a coup, 2014, to get rid of Mohamed Morsi. And the guy in charge now, al-Sisi, is considered by some to be kind of retracing the footsteps of Mubarak. In other words, too authoritarian. So a lot of the hopes and dreams were not really realized. And I think kind of the longer term, it'll be interesting to see how the Arab Spring really shakes out.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for all of those updates.
Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Rob Hugh-Jones, editor at the BBC, right here on Primetime on Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.